Yes, technicians of Spaceship Earth, welcome to Hawk Binge, your spring clean for the dust of time that is the Hawkwind discography, one album at a time, in the company, as ever, of a long-term fan, which is me, and your favourite first-time listener, which is Matt in New York. How's life, Matt?
Not too bad, thanks, Andy. It feels like the year is coming to an end, but there's still lots of good stuff to appreciate in the meantime.
Yes, indeed. I'm looking forward to appreciating some of that with you in person, as I will be out there in December for a couple of weeks.
This will be the first time we've seen each other for like 2 years, maybe?
Yeah. Yep, it will indeed. We'll see how much worse the podcast is when we actually do it in the same room.
When you mentioned that you're coming over, I was thinking, I might start crying. It's been like seasonal affective disorder based over-emotionalism means that anything right now always just makes me go a bit wobbly, which has been interesting given the album as well that we've been dealing with and we'll get to shortly.
Yes, indeed. People often cry when they meet me, but it'd be nice for that to be for a different reason for a change. Well, I've had an interesting time, Matt, because I saw Hawkwind live for the first time since we started doing the podcast. And it's odd how doing the podcast made it into like a bigger deal for me than it would ordinarily be, like a gig amongst many by one of my favorite bands. Suddenly it was like, oh, Hawk Binge. We're at Hawkwind. We made a t-shirt of the Hawk Binge logo and I wore it to the gig just to see if anyone would recognize it and come over and have a chat. I thought the chances were fairly slim because there are a lot of people and it's a reasonably sized venue and obviously only certain numbers of people are going to go there, but actually did meet three fabulous people, Jerry, Chris and Paul. Big shout outs to you. It was awesome to actually meet flesh and blood listeners to Hawk Binge, proving that they are not all bots.
The show itself looked really cool. I saw some of the pictures that you took, like a crazy staring eye over the scene and what looked like a very theatrical light display.
It was the biggest light show I've seen from them for a while. The last album that I saw them tour before the pandemic was All Aboard the Skylark, and the show was much more stripped back lighting-wise. The whole projection thing was completely different. As you say, much bigger show. The musicians were great. I felt that they were louder and heavier than they were on the last tour. So they played things like Brainstorm, which obviously is on the heavy side. And Dave is 80 years old. And it blew my mind that you can do like a, you know, an hour and a half, hour 45 minute show playing things like Brainstorm, where he's doing all of the guitar work, sounding really strong as well. I tweeted that if I can get myself out of a chair unassisted at 80 years old, I'm going to be calling that a win. So yeah, that was pretty good. It was an amazing night. And as I say, Jerry, Chris and Paul, I'm pretty sure you must have enjoyed that one as well. It was an amazing gig. So looking forward to them coming back round again. And hopefully, Matt, them coming round in some kind of way that you can pop over or something and check it out. And what else have you been listening to while I've been going to see Hawkwind live?
Well, it's got to that kind of time again when the nights are drawing in, things are getting a bit colder. And in the same way that a New Yorker has to change their entire wardrobe in order to cope with the winter, which is about to befall us, I also change my playlists out for things which are a little bit more snuggly, a bit more like comforting. One of the playlists which I do enjoy bringing out at this kind of time and also adding to is this kind of, I call it like soft doom playlist, which I have. I like going through albums and picking out the one or two tracks that may exist that are a little bit more pared back, maybe a little bit more atmospheric, you know, still the kind of bands that I would listen to, but just like, just takes the edge off. The kind of thing that you could decorate a Christmas tree to with obviously like all black ornamentation, but that kind of feeling. And I'm going to add to the playlist a new discovery and also a firm favorite. And I'm going to start with the new one. The new one is from an artist called Tony Reed. And Tony Reed is a very prolific singer, songwriter, guitarist. He's in a whole bunch of bands. He's in Moss Generator. He's in Big Scenic Nowhere. He's in Heavy Pink. We've actually seen him play at a festival as Stone Axe.
I remember Stone Axe.
It's a good, solid, doomy kind of stuff. Great fun, but again, not the kind of thing that I would always listen to. But he's just released a new album, which is just a collection of him and his guitar. So it's kind of an acoustic doom because the topics are still very of the genre. And the, you know, like the keys that they play in is all very much that, but it's just kind of like stripped away. The track that I like out of all of them is called Funeral Suit. It's from the album Blood and Strings, the acoustic series volume 2, which means I need to check out the acoustic series volume 1 because I didn't know about this. It's out on Ripple Music and I like a lot of what Ripple Music does, and I grabbed this amazing vinyl which is half black, half white, like kind of cut between. So watching it on the record player is also very cool.
Nice, that sounds great. I remember Stone Axe supporting Samsara Blues Experiment at the Purple Turtle, and I remember the bass player doing the Derek Smalls thing from Spinal Tap of playing the open strings with his right hand and punching the air with his left hand, which was a brilliant moment, particularly given the band name Stone Axe just kind of lends itself to that kind of visual. So yeah, epic choice. Anything else?
I'm going to add a track by Mikey Erg. And Mikey Erg is a very raw, very fast US punk producer where all the tracks last about 3 seconds and go about 3 million BPM. And I actually quite like a lot of his stuff. But on the album Tentative Decisions, out of nowhere, halfway through the album, is this track called Waiting Out the Winter, which is a completely different exploration of his sound. I really like it. It's very DIY. It sounds like he's just put a microphone in the middle of a room and is just playing around it. It's just him strumming a guitar with this punky, tortured sound that he has, this kind of wailing voice. The track, just with every verse, adds more instrumentation until the end. It becomes a very like garage band sounding track. There's also a violin in the middle of it for no real reason, apart from it just kind of again reminded me of a time when I was like, oh yeah, like it's not just Hawkwind I listen to, but suddenly throw surprise violins into the middle of something. I think this might have been one of the tracks which possessed me to make this playlist, thinking, I wonder how many artists I listen to have that one track, which would be interesting to put this compilation to. So yeah, Mikey Erg, Waiting Out the Winter on the album Tentative Decisions on Don Giovanni Records is a winter classic for me and has been for the last 4 or 5 years since I discovered it.
Well, I look forward to checking that out then. Wicked.
And how about you, Andy? What's been on your turntable?
I have also have something new and something a bit older. A few months ago, actually it's probably about a year ago, it was a very lockdown thing. I was listening to on Six Music, a fantastic radio show called The Freak Zone, which is Stuart McConey. It's an absolutely brilliant show. I'd totally recommend it to anyone who's listening to us because it's basically lots and lots of music that would never, ever get played on the radio otherwise. And they have a playlist, which is curated every week. And this playlist of the week was curated by a woman called Gwenifer Raymond. And she was described as an acoustic guitarist playing American primitive and Welsh mystic. So I was kind of, that has to be heard. And her playlist just had loads and loads of things on it that sounded really weird, slightly mystical and occulty. So I listened to all of that. I was really intrigued to find out more. And she was playing in Brighton. So I went to see, and she played a tiny gig, like a homecoming gig in Brighton to about, I don't know, 60 people. And she is amazing. Has to be seen. There's no vocals. There's nothing else apart from her playing acoustic guitar. She plays with a technique that's called claw hammer. So you can imagine having your hand in a claw and you're playing the bass notes with the thumb, strumming with several fingers and picking with several fingers. So it sounds like there are 5 people playing. If you're talking about an acoustic guitarist, my head goes to a Steve Hackett or a Steve Howe or a classical guitarist playing beautiful, quite delicate, fragile classical music. She attacks the guitar basically and like beats 7 bells out of it and is quite clearly well in the zone while doing it. It's incredible the sound that she makes. This American primitive has a kind of Appalachian sound quality to it. A guitarist called Jeff Fahey, I might be pronouncing that wrong, I think is the creator of the term American primitive. But then it has all of this kind of Welsh influence in there. And the only thing I can describe it as, which is probably doing her a severe injustice, is that it reminded me of the kind of acoustic guitar music that Jimmy Page would play in early Led Zeppelin. It's kind of Bronnie Ore and all this kind of thing when they were really into it and they were recording in Wales. That's me having no other references in kind of my catalogue to refer to it. But I really massively recommend checking out some videos of her playing. She has an album called Strange Lights Over Garth Mountain on the label Tompkins Square. It's been receiving big reviews, but it's a sign of the times, I guess, in the music industry that she actually has a job. She is a games developer on the side. And you're kind of watching her play, and that's amazing. So I saw her play again a couple of weeks later in London. She just seemed to pop up playing a jazz festival. Absolutely astounding. The track Hell for Certain is worth checking out. So that's definitely one big discovery, and I am a big fan of that.
That sounds cool. I do like when you can see someone who is clearly lost in the process. You know, that's obviously just very mesmerizing. And one of the great things we've always talked about live music, you know, how actually watching people play is just as interesting as hearing what they're producing.
It's one of those where if you have seen her play, it really adds to the experience of listening to the recorded music.
Cool. So that was your new one, and your old one is what?
My old one is one that won't appeal to you quite so much, because every now and again, I go back to Killing Joke, who you came to see with me and you weren't a massive fan of. But they're a big band for me, and I end up kind of starting off anywhere in the Killing Joke catalogue and then gradually making my way towards a couple of albums that they did. One called Nighttime, which is probably their big album because it was the one that they had some chart success with that has songs like 80s and Love Like Blood on it. But I end up with the album that came about 10 years after that called Extremities, Dirt and Various Repressed Emotions. They'd done several albums before it that were quite synth-based and they'd flopped. They'd been fired from one label and were being sued by another, and it was like they were kind of in ruins. And they've come back with an album on a very, very small label, I think, called Noise Records, who I think were from Germany. I could be wrong. It is an incredibly angry album. I would say it's possessed kind of a righteous fury. It's one of those albums where you can tell that the band are genuinely angry and not just performing and writing angry, and has songs on it with titles like Money Is Not Our God, Age of Greed, Intravenous, things like this. Incredibly aggressive, but with that hollow body guitar sound that guitarist has, absolutely incredible. You'll never hear more energy on a record anywhere. So that's one I always come back to whenever I start listening to Killing Joke. I've been playing that quite a lot recently, and the track of choice there is Intravenous. So two quite distinct choices from the pair of us there for the playlist.
Yeah, some quite nice personal discoveries there, which is always nice to have and share. I feel like I haven't given Killing Joke a second chance. I don't know why it didn't gel for me when I was younger and listening to them, but certainly like 80s is always kind of a stone cold classic. And weirdly, I heard 80s like three or four times in a row about a month ago on a weekend. Like every shop I went into or every restaurant I was in was playing 80s, and I didn't know if that was just a strange aligning of the stars or whether or not there was like a reissue or something going on. But I just listened to it and I was like, I should probably listen to these guys again, because actually, interestingly, I know that since I've ever known you and we've talked music, you mentioned Hawkwind, and I've always been like, yeah, cool, probably, and then never even thought about it. And yet here we are and we're having huge discussions about it. So maybe that's something that I need to check out again, and I will get back to you if I'm able to do that. Maybe that's a Christmas project for me.
Nice one. It's funny, 80s is one of those tracks where whatever mood you're in, 80s comes on and you become its mood. There's lots of music where I can love it if I'm in the mood for it. 80s is one of those triggers, basically, but my mood changes when I hear that. So yeah. Well, before we hit the postbag, we have a thank you to dish out to Steve Roberts. If you're listening, Steve, a big thank you, because on the 25 Years On podcast, the booklet that came out when the tour and also came out, I think, with the first few thousand editions of the vinyl that kind of went into this whole Pan Transcendental Industries story and had some amazing artwork, some incredible Calvert text. And I posted that I didn't have this, and Steve Roberts found that he had two and sent us an absolutely pristine copy of one of these, which is a wonderful thing to do. We then photographed it fairly comprehensively and used Google Lens to get the text out of all the photos so we could transcribe it all and put that up. And actually, that's had quite a lot of response. So thanks to Steve, lots of people have had access to this little piece of Hawkwind paraphernalia that otherwise would have remained hidden. So big thanks to Steve for that one.
It had an interesting effect on me in terms of I liked what I read. I don't think it massively clarified any of the questions that I had for the album, but it did at least build a bit of the world around it. So I felt a little bit more included because, you know, the thing I said was that I felt like Hawkwind were talking about something which I had no context about. At least now I know how deep they were in it. So even though I don't feel like I 100% get it, I at least appreciate their commitment to the theme, you know?
Absolutely. So it's great to share that one. And there will be others. Some I have, some I don't, but we'll try and get them as we get to these things and put them out there for everybody. So we've had a lot of other messages. Let's get into the postbag.
So I would like to thank everyone who has listened to the Quark Strangeness and Charm episode and continues to text, Instagram, tweet, email, any way possible, contact us to let me know that I'm an idiot for not knowing that strangeness and charm are aspects of quarks. The only thing I can imagine is that people listen halfway through that podcast, decide to stop it immediately and shout at me for getting it wrong, and then listen to the rest of the podcast, because I think I have almost as many, oh, you get it, emails as I do, you got this wrong emails. So my favorite one being from Tartan Fox, who just started his email with which normally completely predisposes me to hate whoever sent it. But it was a very just quick note about the strangeness and charm aspects of quarks. And we did reply saying, yes, thank you. And then he did reply saying, yeah, I realized, but then actually went on to talk about his experience with the album, which was great. So I completely forgive you for starting with The other thing was he talked about Damnation Alley being based on a movie, which we have actually found. And although I haven't watched it yet, it's now coming up to Thanksgiving, so I actually have some time. Maybe that's something that we can touch on at some point.
Yes, indeed. I'd suggest a Hawk binge watch along of Damnation Alley, but it might be rubbish, which means that like that after about 10 minutes, everyone would be regretting dialing in.
I kind of want it to be rubbish. I feel like I can get a lot of mileage out of things being rubbish. People who like the original Hawkwind album may disagree how much fun I can have when I don't like something. But certainly, I think it might be worth attempting. Let's see.
Yeah, let's see how it works out. We've had some other lovely messages. Thanks very much to Darren Evanson for posting and kind of promoting us on Facebook, which is very nice of him to do. And got some good replies to that. So welcome aboard to the podcast, Nigel Smith, Spike Gennaro, Dave Gin Goblin, which is a fantastic handle to have. I stumbled across some posts from a while ago, from April, and in fact from January, from Mark Jones and Bill Schwabauer, I hope I've pronounced that right, respectively, who'd tuned in to the very earliest episodes and then posted, you know, I found this thing, it's really good. And I have confirmed that they are still listening to us. So well done for sticking with us. And Stuart Haynes, and also two people who replied to Darren's post that they were really interested and would give us a listen. So Claire Morris and Mikey Watson, if you are indeed listening, if you have managed to check out one or two, then I hope you stay with us and welcome aboard.
Yeah, welcome.
We've also had several of our kind of traditional long My Experience with Hawkwind emails, which we always love. It's a cool thing for us that it provokes people to really kind of dive in and send us these things. So Andrew Greenwood, thanks very much. Love to hear from you. And he's heavily into the various books on Hawkwind. So that's a good one. There's a few of them about. And Dave Bevan, who is particularly keen on all the live albums and kind of wants us to do those. So the good news for you, Dave, is that we are indeed going to do the live albums. The bad news is that that's about 2.5 years away. But if you can stick with us through that time, we will get there eventually.
On the Twitter front, we actually had quite a few people who had some anticipation for 25 years on before we dropped it, which was cool. Or I think as soon as we dropped it, some people immediately said that they had been looking forward to it. Some people saying that it was actually the first Hawkwind album that they'd ever heard, which is interesting considering that it isn't quite a Hawkwind album. So to come in with that and then either to go forward or backward from there would be so different. So I can only imagine what your experience was like from there. But a lot of people said that they really enjoyed the album. And so, yes, I hope that they also then enjoyed what we said about it. Harry Thompson especially said that it was the first one that he had ever experienced under the quote-unquote correct influences. Ming, who is Chaos Not Music on Twitter, said another great episode, chaps, and he thought that my analysis was bang on, which is awesome, considering that I don't always get that as feedback, which is great. So it was also interesting to see what people agreed with. For example, Jones the Boat also thought that he heard Silver Machine in the 25 Years track, which is interesting. He also had an interesting take on what Sky Diaries were, Andy, that, you know, we called out to be like, what might those be? And apparently Bob had aspirations to be a pilot and never made it. So maybe that was something slightly autobiographical in this whole album, more than we thought.
Yeah, apparently Sky Diaries are something that you keep if you are a pilot. So yes, suddenly, after so many years, that reference makes sense. And thanks to Jones and a few others who made that reference for me.
Mm. A few people rushed to the defense of Flying Doctor, which I was kind of surprised about, considering that I thought that it seemed to be like a more universally confusing track. But some people, like Hawk Wayne, replied saying that actually he just finds it a huge amount of fun and really likes Calvert's humor. But also someone who I only know as Rick on YouTube agreed with me and thought that the album was great, blemished, as he says, by the terrible Flying Doctor. So I think that remains with our listenership a controversial track.
Absolutely.
Although some people did reply saying that, according to them, the "so typically Socter" is the actual right lyric, although I completely refuse to believe that that is true. And unless someone sends me some kind of tapestry or Rosetta Stone document that it completely says that exactly what it is, I will continue to believe my side of this story.
And that is the official Hawk Binge stance, because I totally share it. And actually, I don't care if you show me something written down that says it isn't, because I've got albums where the lyrics on the lyric sheet are obviously wrong. So it's scientifically Socter official.
I guess a bit of a running joke from the podcast itself has been my kind of self-admitted dislike of most of the opening tracks that Hawkwind have on their albums. And the fact that I liked the first track on 25 Years had a few people replying that they were happy that that had happened. Philip Gwyn Jones thought that hearing The Only Ones sounded also a bit bowish. So Philip Gwyn Jones, you are currently my listener of the year. So congratulations on that dubious award that I've just given you. But it's funny that Elric Newby on YouTube actually pointed out that, as far as he's concerned, I haven't disliked the first tracks as much as I say I do, pointing out that I said good things about Brainstorm, Psychedelic Warlords, Reefer Madness, and You Shouldn't Do That, which I completely agree. I think that my point has been, I don't think the first track has ever been a contender for a playlist pick, which is, I guess, for me, what I feel like, you know, the creme de la creme of each album is. And I thought that the first track on 25 Years was potentially a contender. So that's, I guess, how I meant it. I don't think there's many things that I have disliked. But in terms of the first track is, you know, is a choice that the band puts first to set some kind of expectation or introduce themselves in an album. And I've always found Hawkwind's first choice often weird, but I felt like the arrangement entirely of 25 Years was pretty much spot on. I don't think I'd want to go in and change a thing. So that was the more remarkable part, rather than me necessarily like dissing on albums. However, podcast in jokes are fun to have. Therefore, I will completely carry on with that where possible.
Yes. And it will be interesting to see if the myth is given further credence today or not. Phil, your prize for being listener of the year is that I stumbled across a tweet of yours talking about a book that you are bringing out next year, The Angels of Venice. So here is a free plug for Philip Quinn Jones, The Angels of Venice, out in the summer of next year. We've had a couple of interesting messages, which are the messages that really do mean so much to us, is people talking about how the podcast makes them think about their own listening experience. So Dunstorm on Twitter messaged just to say that we have kickstarted his brain on how he listens to Hawkwind, and he's revalued his enjoyment of the music as a result. And really, there's nothing better than that than I can think of for someone to say about what we're doing. And Ash, also on Twitter, he said, "I also find Matt's comments provide fresh perspective on things I got into as a 40-year-old groove with. Great to have a prompt to listen to them again with what the Zen tradition would call the beginner's mind. So we love those. And if that's, it's definitely having that effect on me. So absolutely amazing. And Bill Topshoe on YouTube dropped us a comment about the Quark Strangeness and Charm episode. Said some really nice things. He's really enjoying the ride. So thanks very much to you, Bill. We love reading those comments. Lastly here, and I received this one via email actually a couple of episodes ago, but I've saved it up for now because Steve, known as Steam Abacus on SoundCloud, has produced his own remix of Uncle Sam's On Mars and Robot, which he has called Uncle Sam's Robot on Mars. We've saved this one back, obviously, to this episode because obviously these are the tracks on PXR5. But that's really interesting. So check that out. Search for Steam Abacus, two words, on SoundCloud and check out his remix of Uncle Sam's Robot on Mars.
Cool. We can also link that out, I'm sure, in the various notes that we put out with the podcast.
Absolutely.
My last two things from the postbag is that I would like to say hello to friend of the pod, Joe Banks, who did an awesome live stream based on his book talking about Hawkwind's influence on the 70s, which again confirmed a lot of things that we talked about, but also gave me a few extra insights into the band and how they helped shape music going forward, which is super interesting. I think my favorite note on this was the fact that when Lemmy came and joined the band, he'd been a professional musician much longer than the kind of busk vibe that Hawkwind had gone for before. So the fact that Lemmy was the one who was most expecting to be paid and was in that way the most professional musician in the band was kind of an amazing fact, which hadn't really occurred to me before. And the last thing was an anonymous tip we got from Cherry Records' latest compilation of Hawkwind tracks called Dust of Time, charting 1969 to 2021. I don't know if you've seen this, but features artwork of a starry sky, the standing stones of Stonehenge at the bottom, with the word Hawkwind hovering over the top. And I don't know if that sounds familiar.
It does bear something of a passing resemblance to a certain podcast logo. The idea of putting a Hawkwind logo over the top of Stonehenge is absolutely not new. Like, it's been done on the live album, This Is Hawkwind, Do Not Panic, and others. But it's quite interesting when you actually scale these two things together and look at them side by side, how similar the layout is. I think I can speak for both of us here that if this is anything more than pure coincidence, then Matt and I are deeply honored to be a tiny, tiny contributor to the Hawkwind family in some small way.
But if someone also decided just to put the logo over some standing stones, then fair enough.
We did.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a pretty good idea.
And I'm not going to get too annoyed because this is the last album of the 70s and we will be changing our artwork for season two of the podcast anyway. So as far as I'm concerned, they're welcome to it.
And with that, it is time to get in the time machine and go back to 1979. So we are in 1979, and again, there is quite a big mishmash of different types of music going on here. But interestingly, the music that you would think of as early 70s music is indeed being played by early 70s bands. So it's a mixture of old bands keeping on doing what they're doing and new bands doing something entirely new. And you'll see that in this list here. So we have in 1979, Spirits Have Flown by the Bee Gees, Force Majeure, A Tangerine Dream, Live at the Witch Trials and Bragnet by The Fall. Two albums there. Van Halen 2 by Van Halen. Motörhead come out with two albums, Overkill and Bomber. Bomber, a particular favourite of mine. Life in a Day by Simple Minds. ABBA release Voulez-Vous, which is actually one of my favourite ABBA albums. Bad Girls by Donna Summer. Gary Numan comes out with probably the two really big albums in his career, Replicas and The Pleasure Principle. Brilliant they are too. Three Imaginary Boys by The Cure. David Bowie comes out with Lodger this year. Diana Ross brings out The Boss. Discovery by the Electric Light Orchestra. Pink Floyd bring out the obviously huge The Wall. Back in the Egg by Wings. I Am by Earth, Wind and Fire. Unknown Pleasures by Joy Division and Mirrors by Blue Oyster Cult. So already you can see a huge variety of the music here. Neil Young and Crazy Horse come out with Rust Never Sleeps this year. The B-52's eponymous album is out this year. London Calling, probably the biggest of the Clash albums, is out in 1979. Throbbing Gristle with the beautifully named 20 Jazz Funk Greats. Fear of Music by Talking Heads, Off the Wall by Michael Jackson. XTC come out with Drums and Wires. The last kind of studio recorded Led Zeppelin album, In Through the Outdoor, is out this year. Pat Benatar, In the Heat of the Night. Frank Zappa comes out with four albums. One of them a double this year, Joe's Garage Act 1, Joe's Garage Acts 2 and 3, and Orchestral Favourites and Sleep Dirt. So it's Frank being very frank. Different Kind of Tension by the Buzzcocks. The Police release Regatta de Blanc. Tusk comes out by Fleetwood Mac, their follow-up to Rumours. Blondie, Eat to the Beat. The eponymous album from Prince. Toto come out with Hydra. Pill come out with the amazing Metal Box, Public Image Limited. Amazing album, that is. The Jam with Setting Suns and Whatever You Want from Status Quo. So a huge variety of bands in completely different parts of their career releasing such completely different music. It's a pretty interesting year to be releasing an album. And in that environment, Hawkwind release PXR5. Now, when we're looking at Hawkwind at this point, this is a bit more straightforward because the story's basically been completely set up in the previous episode. But just to quickly recap, the band releases Quark, toured, imploded, regrouped, recorded much of this, split up, shelved it, released Hawkwinds with a completely different lineup, toured it, and then Charisma released the shelved album. That brings us right up to date, so I hope everyone followed that. So this is the last of the Calvert albums. It's the last Charisma album. It's the last 1970s album. But really, was all over the year before, because of course this was released after the Hawklords album. So really, at the end of that Hawklords story, it's over. So one wonders whether this was released to honour the four-album Charisma contract that Hawkwind had and kind of bring that to a close. And it does give the impression, rather, of being pulled off the shelf. Several of the tracks are overdubbed live performances rather than kind of full-on studio recordings. Two of the songs are just Dave doing everything, with Simon King playing the drums, and apparently were intended for a Dave Brock solo album. So you do get the impression that this is a band who have ceased trading. Dave Brock, who is no fan of this album, called this an album of bits and bobs. And it's surprising he doesn't like it, because unlike Astounding Sounds, he's all over this one. So into the studio 2 years ago went Bob Calvert, Dave Brock, Adrian Shaw, Simon House, and Simon King, the Quark lineup. They're in the studio in January 78. The live stuff that they recorded over and overdubbed is from September 77. So they were playing these new tracks on the Quark tour. It hit the charts at number 59, which is very low for Hawkwind at this point in their career, bearing in mind Quark came in at number 30 and 25 Years made number 48. So there seems to be a fair bit of damage done by the messing around with the name and not really forcing the issue of where they were with Quark, which seemed to give them such a platform to build on. So in a world of confusion, there was a poster that was posted on Twitter of a Hawkwind gig during the Hawklords era that was actually promoted as Hawkwind stroke Hawklords. So even the band don't know who they are at that point. That's the environment into which PXR5 is released. Let's see what Matt makes of it.
With this album's weird name, new band font, and illustrated cover, before I'd heard a single track on this album, I was wondering whether or not this was signs of Hawkwind regressing after Quark. And I do feel like the album overall sounds like a regression from 25 Years, but that's also more due to the fact that it was recorded first. So I know the fact that this came out afterwards, even though it was recorded first, does put it in a difficult position, because I think if you go Quark this 25 Years, I think the sound makes more sense. However, from a release point of view and how we've done it, that isn't actually how it is. So that this is just what we're dealing with. But when I talk about regression, I mean the fact that they've gone back to illustration over photography, or even that strange half photography, half illustration feel that we had for Quark. PXR5 immediately sounds more spacey or more technical than we had before. So I felt like, are they going back to stories? Are they trying to retain that space rock where before it felt like they'd become that more socio-political commentary kind of band? So I was expecting a bit more more of that fancifulness to come back in. And I think to a large point, they do that. So I do feel that a lot of my first impressions based on just looking at the cover actually bore out. I think the vibe of this album feels much like the band took a lot of what they learned about songcraft from the new people who've come in and then the people who have been before and have applied it much more to what they were quote unquote famous for, which is more fantastical stories and some countercultural social commentary. So I feel like they've taken what was good about where they've come from, looked back at the content that they enjoyed and tried to see whether or not this would like squidge together. I think for the most part, despite everything that you just said that I wasn't 100% sure about, I don't think it's an album that sounds as lackluster as it could have done given how it was made. I think if I was Dave, I'd be reasonably proud of this, or at least some parts of it. Comparing this to 25 Years, PXR5 is actually a better album, but there are songs on 25 Years that I would say are better in comparison to any song on PXR5. It's been a strange back-to-back album comparison and listening experience, just thinking about this. Like sound-wise as well, and now you've just said that they overdubbed live things, it doesn't sound as good. Like 25 Years sounds way better, but that was all studio. So this does sound regressive in some of the way that Hawkwind has made music before. And I know that Dave was sometimes more into the fuzzy, grungy stuff, where I'm not always so much. But the overdubs on this actually are interesting. And we'll come to that track by track, because I've actually made some notes saying I thought maybe that was done on purpose. But now you said that, it does sound like I can hear what was live and now I can hear what was put over it. But I actually kind of like that. The crispness of some things throw the fuzz into a sharp relief, which you can then look at and appreciate in the contrast, where when everything's a bit fuzzy, that's what it is. And you deal with it in a different kind of way. Overall, as we close out the 70s of Hawkwind, I can see how people have described them previously in conversation, and even how you said, like when we first started this, is that Hawkwind is seen as a live act band or even a compilation or playlist band. Because looking back at everything we've talked about in the 70s, I think that the master playlist, for example, we have is pretty fire. And that's largely due to the omission of some tracks that can be very flow breaking or weird or don't really feel like they belong somewhere. So you can definitely pick a really strong double compilation album out of the 70s of Hawkwind and look at it and go, what an amazing band. And it's very interesting to go through the Warts and All albums and really look at it, because then it becomes a very different listening experience. So on the whole, I have enjoyed this album in a very different way. And I'm still kind of working out where it is in my opinions and estimations of everything. But the idea of Hawkwind taking some of the stuff that they did and going back to some of the things that we haven't heard for a while was kind of refreshing, I guess, given the last couple of albums that we've had. But it's not the disaster that I thought the story that you told me made it feel like.
I've definitely got a soft spot for this one. It was one of the ones that I would have got quite early. And I would have got this before I knew anything about the story of the band. And it always felt like one of a pair with Quark. In fact, I believe there were issues of them as a double album pair. So, yeah, I think there are some beautiful moments on it. If you don't know how it's been put together, you wouldn't work it out by listening to it. So I totally agree with you. And funnily enough, I'm slightly different than you, that actually I would be more likely to listen to this than 25 Years. But that may be just the familiarity I had with it. Let's find out as we go track by track. And we begin with Death Trap,
which for me is another pretty solid opening track as Hawkwind opening tracks go. It's certainly something which I don't hate. I think it's nowhere near the best track on the album, but it is a solid track. And one that, again, made me feel that I may have been right about Hawkwind looking over their shoulder as they were making this album, because I do feel like there are quite a few callbacks to Quark in a lot of the content. For me, this track feels like the internal monologue of the guy from Damnation Alley after the initial thrill of driving around a post-apocalyptic US wears off. You know, like before, there was this idea of he's got this crazy machine and there's an open road and like he's survived and let's see what this new way of life might bring. And now this guy's got this strange messiah complex, the jubilation's gone, and it feels more like kind of manic resignation to the situation instead, rather than this reckless abandon. It feels more like he's just got this grim job to do. It's like, I've got to keep this thing rolling or it's just game over. The whole thing could be sung through clenched teeth. In that kind of human way that like, even when failure is absolutely guaranteed, almost out of spite, surviving as long as possible is a kind of a very human thing. So the fact that this guy is now calling his vehicle a death trap, like when people would call their World War II plane their rust bucket because the chance of it breaking down was actually more likely than them getting shot by the enemy. You know, that idea of like, but you still do it because you have to. So you may as well make a bit of gallows humor as you go. And I feel like there's a lot of gallows humor in this track. Musically, I also feel like things have changed in terms of the vibe, because Damnation Alley was kind of upbeat in the way it worked, an almost ironic truck rock kind of thing where they took that and subverted it with the lyrics. This now is much more subdued, like the chords are very simple, they batter along, which again makes me feel like the music is going on with this idea of like, we're just keeping on, we're not doing anything special, full speed ahead, just like wide-eyed, froth-mouthed attempt to just keep going forward for as long as possible, which is kind of what the actual like track does with its fairly basic percussion, fairly basic chords, but it just, you know, it's all about forward motion as much as possible. So yeah, that then for me reflects that difference. There's no great breakdown, which we had before, which again just adds to this idea of this is all just about the last few seconds of this narrator before he meets some kind of fiery death. And I think that's further compounded when they do the breakdown, where they start listing all the problems with the car, which I thought was actually quite an imaginative way of doing a breakdown, because every time he adds a new thing, you're just like, oh yeah, there's another reason why this thing is not going to last the night. I did think the order of it was a bit weird, because when they say tires are on fire now, I was like, we'll probably just draw a line under that. Like, if your tires are on fire, then the fact that your spark plug doesn't work or whatever is probably the least of your worries at that point. I do like the repetition of Death Trap. Also, the chicken running is just like the way that is uttered has a nice extra percussive element to it that just keeps that rolling. I don't know if it is canon or anything, that it is related to Damnation Alley or not, but I can't see how you wouldn't think that if you'd heard the other album. I do like how it ends with switching Death Trap to Death Wish. The first time I heard it all the way through and then it ended on Death Wish, I was like, oh, okay. Now I have to readjust my expectations again, because that for me gave quite a lot of questions. I was thinking like, could it be that our distracted driver narrator finally ran into a wall and that was the last thing he shouted before, like, you know, he met some kind of fiery end? Or is it actually like a final jubilant cry that underpins this idea that the driver is still kind of enjoying things? You know, like Damnation Alley, he still called this thing, this big anti-radiation tomb. So there was this idea that he'll die in it eventually. It is a death trap, but I have a death wish. So actually, this is exactly where it should be. That full on, I've gone crazy, Mad Max thing. I really like that switch at the end, because I wasn't expecting it. And it eventually made me feel like this is still a strangely joyous record, but it is joyous in that kind of way where you're trying to extract any kind of fun or purpose or meaning from a situation which you are no longer in control of. And the only thing you can do is perpetuate existence until failure.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. To me, it's their most overtly punk sounding track, because there is no orchestration really comes in any particularly complicated way. The guitar solo matches the tone of the song perfectly. It's very, very simple. It could easily be a Ramones track, if you see what I mean. And the way that Calvert sings it, that has authenticity. It doesn't sound like a big old space rock band trying to get in with the kids. It sounds completely authentic as its own punk track, because obviously, as we've talked about at length before, of their role in all of that. But it works. Dave's kind of choppy guitar style makes that work. And the fact that they don't overplay it, it's minimal at the beginning, it's minimal in the middle, which was hard to say, and it's still minimal at the end. I think they really serve the song really, really well. And to your point, the way that Calvert percussively delivers the lyrics and the way that the band are holding that death trap thing going as well, it's a strong one for me. It's not the strongest on the album by a long shot, but it is a strong start to an album. It definitely is an attention grabber for sure. And you're right, it does serve a similar purpose, if you like, to Damnation Alley. And it's hard not to think of them as a pair. But there's quite a marked difference to where that takes us next.
For the Jack of Shadows, this is for me, the regression piece. Before it was a callback, this for me is full on, we're back to more Warrior on the Edge of Time telling spacey stories or stories of fantasy and time travel and that kind of thing. And I feel like I know Hawkwind enough now to know this is certainly about a book or poem or something in that style now.
Roger Zelazny.
Bless you.
Book of the same name.
Okay, cool. So compared to Warrior, which I felt like was a little bit more impenetrable, this one for me feels much more accessible, whether that's because of the content of the book or whether or not they're just using more generally evocative images and languages, I'm not sure. But this one worked for me a lot more. I didn't feel like I had to know the book in order to go, oh, I get all these references. It felt like a space folk tale. The kind of song that you might sing as legend of this Jack of Shadows who comes in and does all this stuff. You know, it was almost like that folk style, Here Comes the Spider-Man kind of song that people throw into the films and stuff, where like he becomes this kind of folk hero. It kind of reminded me of like that, but like, you know, elevated to levels of space imagination. There's some interesting and also familiar linguistic uses in this. They use the phrase the other side of light, which reminds me of the other side of the sky, which we got from Silver Machine. I was surprised that they used the word molasses. I mean, it's a good word. It sounds fun to say, and it rhymes nicely with what they're doing. But as far as I know, that's a very American word for what we would call treacle. I don't know, again, if that's something to do with the book or whether or not they just used it because they needed something that was very dark and moved in a kind of gloopy way, because that helps. But like, if I had listened to this before coming to America, I would have had to have looked that word up, because I don't think I've ever used that in my life. And the only reason I know that is because I looked at it once on a diner menu and thought, what was that?
Yeah, fair. Knowing that it's a reference to a book doesn't really help you if you've not read the book, which neither of us have. But you hadn't read the Moorcock books, obviously, that inspired Warrior Rangers of Time. But you can get your head into what's going on in this track easier not having read it than you probably could with Michael Moorcock's worlds of multiverse of lore and chaos.
Yeah, maybe. I feel like there's a few on Warrior that, like Magnu, for example, I got more, because they say Magnu is a horse with a golden mane, and then they talk about it. And they're like, cool, okay, we're singing about a horse, space horse. I can deal with this. So this person as well is some kind of time thief. So the information that I'm given is enough for me to feel like, oh, this guy sounds fun. Like I said, like that's what you do with heroic folk tales, is that you take the bits that people can relate to and be like, that's what this person's all about. The content is fine. Is it my favorite thing that Hawkwind do? Probably not. I prefer their more biting social commentary, or they're completely out there talking about space in the weird ways like, I'm going to forget the track now, so that's not really helpful.
Pretty much anything from 1971.
Yeah, I should have made a note. I just forgot. Actually, I didn't only just came to that point now as we were talking.
No, I think I get where you're coming from. I think musically, it's much lighter in tone. So it kind of passes its few minutes perfectly pleasantly. You can kind of hum it walking along the road. It's not one of the album's high points, but it's not a low point either.
I agree with that. There's some nice little flourishes, like the little castanet that they throw in there. I could see this Jack of Shadows like laying one red rose in the space of the place where he's just stolen something from. Like you kind of get in like a Carmen Sandiego kind of situation. You know, I don't know why that castanet just like evokes that feeling of he's got some flair and panache. And like, again, that's that kind of like folktale of like adding all this description. You could say like he's 10 feet tall and has a cloak made of space. And you're like, yeah, sure. Why not? This guy's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's done very faithfully for what it is, you know, in the same way that actually like Death Trap, I think, again, the same thing, there's a faithfulness to it, and you can like it or not, but you can't say it doesn't do what it sets out to do. So I think these are very well realized tracks. And again, both of these, like you say, don't pique my interest in the same way that some Hawkwind tracks have done, but as tracks, I'm completely fine with them and enjoy them when I listen to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, saying that you prefer Hawkwind's more socially conscious stuff brings us to Uncle Sam's on Mars, because obviously in the mid-70s was when the Viking landers actually did land on Mars, hence the track. It's a pretty obvious callback to Whitey on the Moon, which is Gil Scott-Heron, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And clearly is about commercialization and homogenization. I remember when I found out somebody said there was a Coca-Cola vending machine in every major city on the planet. So this one definitely is back in the realms of social commentary.
And what an oddly poignant track to be listening to in this COP26 season that we find ourselves in, when, you know, the planet is very much being talked about in a literally, we've been talking about this for 26 years and we should really do something because, come on, guys, seriously, it's interesting to hear about this. But yeah, for me, this is now firmly back into the bit of Hawkwind where they nail this kind of stuff. I'm assuming this is an overdub live, because this is what I was talking about in terms of the vocals and the music sound very different. The vocals are very clear, which makes me feel like this is something that they wanted you to listen to. You know, this is almost like a PSA from Hawkwind, but the music really helps carry it. So they do have equal weight, but there's a difference in focus in the way that these things work. I actually think Whitey's on the Moon is one of my favorite poems ever. I think it's just amazingly put together. It obviously carries a huge amount of baggage, but it wears it proudly. It almost like bench presses the amount of baggage it's holding, you know, with this kind of like this feeling of like self-awareness and referentialness. And like, this is something that no one's talking about, was really cool. So to hear this version of it is interesting, because this is almost a white person's version of Whitey's on the Moon, where we're like, sure, white people might be on the moon, but there are some white people that are way more on the moon than other white people. And we're going to point that out. You know, this kind of like feeling when the pendulum swung, didn't it? Where like America in the 50s, for example, was like the thing which everyone saw as being basically like the new Rome. They were making all these labor saving devices. They had cars, they had the American dream, all this kind of stuff. But then, you know, one Great Depression, one Vietnam later, and suddenly like the mask slips a bit and everyone realizes that maybe hyper-capitalism is not quite what we felt like we all needed. And the cracks begin to show. And this is very much Hawkwind of calling attention to the harm that all this does, and accusing America of basically not paying attention to where they are, because they're already potentially beyond this. You know, they're already looking at things in a way which means that everyone else has to like suck on their exhaust while they fire out into new places. And they're not being globally minded, they're not being socially minded, they're not even being humane in a lot of this. So there's a lot to unpack in this. It is very heavy, but I think it's done in a way which balances itself really nicely. You know, like it could be much more finger waggy, it could be a lot more intense, which then also makes it in a way a lot easier to tune out. But using this idea of Uncle Sam's on Mars is much more evocative, and you put yourself into it, which means you get sucked into it, but you kind of like allow yourself to be sucked into it because it hooks you in. The first verse, for example, is fantastic. That escalation by talking about like the fish are dead. So that's very granular. That's very real. And then that goes up to, and then science has a lot to answer for. And then you go up even further to, there may well be no stopping this. Already you've gone from something I can relate to here's the problem in three lines. And just every single time you intersperse it with, but Uncle Sam's on Mars, as in like the person who is doing this doesn't care. They're not around. They flick the match behind them as they're walking out. So that amazing idea of real existential threat mixed with that human behavior of not paying attention is just bottled up in a fantastically eloquent speech, which is then surrounded by this swirling live Hawkwind jam, which again is going back to the stuff that they did before, but this just works. And like I said, it sounds a bit fuzzy around the edges, but for me, that actually helps bring the vocals, which they've overdubbed, to the front again. It kind of does what We Are the Soldiers on the Edge of Time didn't do for me. You know, well, like that was a bit too theatrical. This is just this big swirling mess, and you can hear the synths trilling around. You can hear the guitar grabbing all that bottom end and just creating this, I call it this kind of like dust cloud of sound around this person who is talking. Or is it maybe people? I don't know whether or not there's any phasing or some kind of processing on the actual vocals, or if two people are talking and one of them is in a much lower register. We're almost hearing from some kind of like superhuman who is talking in this strange, slightly inhuman way, you know, like this idea of this kind of messenger who's in the earth in the same way that like Fable of a Failed Race was. You know, we hear the story of the people where this happened to them. They're down there still on earth pointing out all this is happening. And then just to pepper in that little phone call of the president talking to the astronauts brings it smack bang down to earth again. I know it's a quote, and we haven't really heard Hawkwind do much with found sound, so it's interesting to hear this. It adds this extra layer of this is right now or this is happening. So there's, again, this crazy lasagna of context here where we've got this poem that they're referencing and then all the socio-political stuff, all the environmental stuff, all these layers of their own kind of imagination ways of dealing with it, and then real-time talking about America. And, you know, it just becomes this crazy thing where, like, no matter how you slice it, there's just this whole bunch of context that you just have to, like, deal with. And the music isn't, like, letting up either. So it's just pulling you through this thought. It goes absolutely crazy. It's a very intense 8 minutes.
It is, but it's not huge and weighty like a Black Sabbath slab dragging you down. It propels along forwards, which is almost part of it, this kind of progress. And as you said, not just with COP26, but also this era of Bezos and Branson and Musk all kind of racing to the stars for billions of dollars and trying to get to Mars. Not to say that it's prescient, but it's absolutely not of its time. This is current. It reminds me structurally of Spirit of the Age, in as much as this is about what Calvert is saying and the band just playing something to back it up. I remember you suggested that for you, musically, Spirit of the Age was like a 5 out of 10. And people thought that you thought it was a 5 out of 10 track, but you were just talking about the music and the words were a different thing altogether. I think this track with a different lyric would be entirely different. I think this is carried along by the words, but the band back it up beautifully. The music just fits and has a almost 1950s science fiction TV serial feel to me. They actually played this on the gig that I went to a few weeks ago, which was absolutely brilliant. I think there is footage of it online somewhere. I'll dig it out. So yeah, definitely a high point. Very famous in Hawkwind lore, this one. And a couple of pods ago referred to the band playing at festivals and Calvert cutting up an American flag with a sword. Pretty sure this was the song.
That would make sense because I feel like America doesn't come off very well in this song. So the one thing that always pulls me out of this slightly is the McDonald's hamburger, which is just shouted. I know that like McDonald's has become the de facto sign of global capitalism gone wrong. And I know that it was more prescient then, but I feel like it's almost, it's not quaint now, but it's a bit passé. Like we know that now. So, and again, back then it's fine and we're here now, but just listening to it now, I really wish that vocal wasn't there because it just feels a little dated somehow, a little passé in why they're having a go at America.
He picked the right brand though, because if he'd have gone with, you know, back then, which he could have done, if he'd gone for Wimpy, no one would understand the reference anymore.
That is true. That just proves that, unfortunately, despite their best efforts, Hawkwind didn't do much to diminish McDonald's iron grip on the restaurant industry.
No, indeed. That is true.
There's this one thing where they talk about two cars in the garage. And I was trying to figure out whether or not that was more of a cutting comment about America's 50s idea of, like, you know, there was that idea of a car in every garage and a washing machine in every home.
Yeah, nuclear family.
Yeah, so I feel like that was much more of a cutting point because there's that idea of, like, you as America have said that you want your people to have this amazing life, and yet that is ruining the planet, but you don't care because you're not even on this planet. For me, that's way more intelligent than just shouting, McDonald's exists.
I do love the delivery of it, though, I must admit. I do love the way that he says hamburger and the way that he says two cars in the garage. I love that. That always makes me smile. And it, in many ways, this very much feels like late 1960s underground movement, Bob Calvert coming right back to the fore again. So obviously a huge track with Hawkwind fans for very good reason.
And for new fans as well.
And that's good to know. And we go to something entirely different, which is one of those tracks that was originally apparently destined for a Dave Brock solo album, which is just him and Simon King playing the drums. Two of these on the trot. The first one is Infinity.
The fact that this might have been for his own work makes sense to me. This track is hard work. I like it musically. I like the way that it changes chord. You know, it hits all these nice resolutions as it goes through its progression, like the bass comes in and hits the tonic note and everything kind of comes together. There's a very nice plucky guitar mixed with this kind of large bass note, which pulls things together. The thing which really just makes me unable to deal with this track is the accent that it's sung in. It just sounds a bit silly to me. I find it very hard to take it seriously.
It's quite nasal, isn't it?
I actually wrote this. Yes, the nasality in twang makes me feel like this is more of a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy story than a more tragic story, which I think it's supposed to be. Because, you know, this idea of, again, a fable of a failed race kind of thing. It's another one of these little like space stories or fantasy stories of someone who's found themselves in this terrible situation. And I read the lyrics. The lyrics are nice, but there's just something about the way it's delivered that makes me feel like it's being a little silly and I can't deal with it. So I like it musically and I like the last third of it, because then not only do the lyrics go away, but they actually bring in a little bit more of a defined guitar, which helps like pick out the end of it, which then makes it a nice little palate cleanser for me. But yeah, the track on the whole, I have problems with the singing.
Yeah, and the singing is the thing that knocks a couple of marks off it for me too. Otherwise, it's quite a nice little song. I'm quite happy to sink into it a bit, but I wish that Dave was singing it with his normal singing voice. I wonder why he did it.
If this person's been stuck for a very long time and he's going to be stuck there for infinity, I was wondering whether or not it's almost like they're very far away, like in time or something, or like the memory of this person is kind of like fading. So this idea of this delivery being deliberately weak, that's the only kind of explanation I have, is that they're trying to get this feeling of someone who's kind of being diminished and stuck where they are. You could do it angrily, I guess, like, oh, I'm stuck here for infinity. But I feel like the way that infinity is delivered in that repetitious way, again, it works. It's just, there's something about the delivery which I find hard to get over, but I also don't know how else you would do it.
Nope, that's totally fair. I'm with you. And it was that way to me when I first heard the track. So it's interesting when you come back to something you haven't heard for quite a long time and actually you realize you feel exactly the same way about it as you did before, which is totally not, I don't like this track. It's perfectly fine. I would never dream of skipping it. But yes, the delivery is slightly jarring. The second of these two tracks is then Life Form, which I don't know if you'd agree, but for me, almost feels like it's doing the same job as Automaton from 25 Years.
Yeah, and I didn't really like what Automaton was doing, so I'll put it into my things which Hawkwind have done, which are okay, which I can also take or leave. This one's a bit of a puzzle, though, because it's not short enough to be a real micro track, but it's also not long enough to be a full track. Considering we have Infinity, which takes us down from what has been quite a heavy track that we just had, and then we have Lifeform back to back, we need one or the other. I don't know why we have both of these. And the only thing I was thinking of is the fact that I would assume that Lifeform is the first track on the B side.
Nope, Lifeform is the last track on the A side.
Oh, in that case, then it has absolutely no business being here as far as I'm concerned.
You were thinking record length, right, for the vinyl?
I was just thinking maybe like you want to end on Infinity to end that side. And then if you turn it over, maybe, I don't know, you put the kettle on or something in between flipping the record over or something. You want to carry on that vibe and you want to be led into what is then going to be a pretty heavy B-side. I assume that that's why that was there. But to go straight from Infinity into Lifeform and then end the side is very odd to me. So yeah, I don't really know what's going on there.
I'm with you. Again, it's not one that I skip. I'm quite happy when it comes on, but it wouldn't really make an awful lot of difference to me if suddenly it disappeared from the album. If Infinity disappeared from the album, I'd notice its absence. Lifeform, less so. But again, when it comes on, I'm not like tempted to skip on or anything like that.
No. Again, I could have put Lifeform as the very first track just to set some kind of tone for the track or something. Like, I don't know where else it would go. Like, it doesn't really want to go any later in the album unless it was like the very last thing. Or maybe you could put it after High Rise just to get us back to feeling spacey again after that for PXR5. I don't know. Like, I guess if I was going to move it, I would put it probably there. Because it's not, like I said, it's not hurting me listening to it. You know, it doesn't outstay its welcome.
Yes, agreed. And so ends side one of the vinyl. We flip over and we get The Mighty Robot, which, as you will be well aware, is inspired by Isaac Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics, which I'm sure you knew. Do you know what they are?
Let me see if I can do this off the top of my head. I don't know if I'm going to get this verbatim. I know that a robot cannot harm or through an action enable harm to a human.
That is the first law.
The second one, is it that they have to do whatever a human says?
Yep, except where it conflicts with the first law.
Right, and then they are unable to destroy themselves?
Yes, well done. Well done. Maximum points, except, of course, where that conflicts with the others. Did you know that there is a fourth law?
I actually wrote in my notes that I made up a fourth law that I thought would have been good, and now I've lost it.
Oh, this is tense then, because there is a fourth law. It's written about 30 years later or something in another book. And it's actually not the fourth law. It's the zeroth law.
Oh, okay.
But go for it. Let's see if you can independently go where Isaac Asimov took 30 years to get.
Well, for me, just based on the kind of like the Blade Runner stuff and even like some of the stuff that's in these lyrics, I had that a robot is unable to lie about being a robot if you ask it if it is.
No. No bonus points. So the zeroth law of robotics is that a robot cannot harm humanity or by inaction allow humanity to be harmed, which basically allows the robot to kill Hitler or such and such. He doesn't kill Hitler in the books because it's set 50 billion years in the future, but that's there is some kind of humanity facing threat and robot could prevent it. So there you go. That's the zeroth law that nobody knows. But yeah, so we have robot, and it did always used to please me when he sang the three laws of robotics, because I was avidly reading Isaac Asimov at the time when I got this album.
Well, also, like, Asimov liked to mess with his own rules. I remember there was a book of Asimov's short stories that I had where a child told her toy robot to get lost, and then the robot took it literally. And then there was this whole story about, like, where the robot could have gone that wouldn't inflict with the laws and how they could then get it back. And that kind of thing of just like, oh, yeah, Asimov didn't just write these three laws and call it a day. So they were some really interesting thought exercises. And the way that Hawkwind take it, I don't think any other band would have got to where they are here. There's this obvious layer of Asimovian vision of the robot servant with their three laws that keep humanity safe in this world where robots exist. But then there's this other very Hawkwindian layer about the concept of an indentured underclass, you know, which is unable to realize their full potential due to these kind of mind shackles that they have. So again, there's a lot to unpack in this. Uncle Sam's on Mars is much more direct about what's going on because it's talking about real things, where obviously robots are not real yet. But there is this extra layer in here as well, where I do feel like you could use this story as an analogy for the working class. The idea that the working class hold the power potentially in their hands, but they obey laws of society that go against their ability to fight for a better situation. I wasn't sure if I was making that up, but the fact that they kind of whisper at the end of the track, "You're all robots," makes me feel like this is actually more intentional. And although it's kind of, you know, buried in layers of symbolism, I feel like Hawkwind could be telling the listener, you are essentially, in the eyes of some people, a robot.
I would say that's pretty spot on. I think for one thing, a lot of the best science fiction is actually a metaphor for current social commentary. And two, I think Hawkwind generally have used science fiction settings to reflect back. And yeah, I don't doubt it. It's not explicitly done. But I think the fact that it allows you to make that connection is a powerful thing. And the music backs it up.
It's more of a story song. Do you know what I mean? Because normally, like, I feel like the music would work and then the lyrics would work around it. Again, I feel like the lyrics are driving this. There's a musical accompaniment that works well, but it certainly feels like the story and the lyrics are the most important part of this. To that point, the story is really interesting. It feels very Hawkwind to tell the story of robot servitude in such a pedestrian fashion. The idea that they have to commute, the fact that they have to queue, the fact that they're doing all the boring stuff just adds this empathic layer to their situation that I don't think many other bands would have got to. You know, they'd have either talked about uprising or they'd just say robots suck. But this idea of, again, painting this grey, grim picture of a robot at the back of the bus traveling to do something boring. The phrase, "you're a good morning machine," is one of the most brutal cut downs of someone's existence that I think I can ever really think of. You know, it's not rude or insulting, it's just bleak.
Yes, it is. And so simple. It's one of those phrases where if somebody said it to you, you'd have walked 50 yards before you realized how devastated you were.
Exactly. It's simple, but it took a lot of thought to get there, I'm sure. This is the track that Hawkwind are building to in the whole album. You know, this is the only one that's really of some length. It's the only one that has a Hawkwindian breakdown in it. Even though it's different to something like what Quark did or what 25 Years did, it still has much more of a breakdown to it and a rebuild up. And actually, they just repeat the whole thing over. So it's kind of like, we are going to make this point. And actually, I don't mind it doing that. I think it works nicely because I do like the story and I do like it being told twice in one sitting in that way. With that in mind, I do find it funny that in that same way that like Metropolis and other films of this era and slightly earlier, is that it's funny how people have crazy imaginations for what humanoid robots could achieve or where technology could take the idea of robot automatons, but they still talk about queuing for buses and papers. So like, no one can envisage an iPad, but everyone can assume that one day we'll make robots smart enough to even deal with what these three, like the zeroth law. How much computer metacognitive processing power would it take a robot to understand what humanity is and what a threat to humanity is in order to even obey that law, you know? But they've still got newspapers, which is kind of amazing when you think about it.
Absolutely. I don't need an iPad if I've got a robot to read me the news.
But they have to read it from a paper. They don't download it from the internet. They actually have to go and get you a paper and then read it.
No, exactly. They have to go to the shop and buy it.
I do like this track. I think that it still somehow doesn't have quite the same imagination flair as something like Quark or 25 Years has for me in terms of like the musicality of this piece. I feel like they could have broken this down in a much more Steppenwolf way if they wanted to, because they're very good at making a break in the story and doing that. But again, as we've said before, with all these tracks, maybe it doesn't actually help the vision of this piece. Maybe it does need to feel like it's still, again, a little bit depressive, a little bit repressive. You want to feel like you are being like downtrodden a little bit listening to it because you are one of these robots. So I think it lands this point home. The only thing I don't think it does necessarily is stick the landing for me. Dave coming in doing the R-O-B-O-T bit with his accent throws me again. You can just hear him in the background going R-O-B-O-T. It's like, R. There's something about how he sings, which again is obviously how he does, because when we listen to Somnia, when he even does, he does his Talky Dave parts, that's how he is, which is, again, fine. It's him, it's his band. But there's something about the accent that always gets me compared to Calvert, I think, because he's so neutral. It always clashes to me a little bit. And then it does that automaton thing where it speeds up to a crazy amount and eventually just flies off the handle and just comes to a kind of an abrupt end. It's probably not a better way to finish the track, I guess. I just don't quite get Hawkwind's fascination with this speedy up thing, considering that they've done it so many times so recently.
They do the spelling things out thing quite a lot. It did occur to me, not that I don't like it, but there's more of it to come. You'll spot it now that we've said it. It did occur to me that a playlist of Hawkwind spelling things out would actually be quite funny.
Space and spell.
That's exactly. Space and spell. Very good. So Talk of Bleakness takes us to High Rise, probably the emotional high point or down point, I guess, of the album. And unusual for Hawkwind, but an amazing track. And Joe Banks, we haven't referred to either of our two usual authors yet, but I'm about to do that now. Joe Banks actually says something pretty beautiful about High Rise. We know that it's based on J.G. Ballard's book of the same name. And Joe writes, "The title nods to Ballard, but the words are inspired by Calvert's experience of living in a Margate tower block. His depiction of boredom-fueled vandalism amid brutalist architecture could have come from a contemporary Sunday supplement, where high-rise estates were routinely condemned as spirit-sapping slums in the skies. For Calvert, they're the epitome of a dehumanized future where dignity is sacrificed to the cold bureaucracy of central planning. High-rise is full of melodic pathos, and its chorus delivers a genuine emotional punch, harmony backing vocals bristling with Calvert's caged up rage." Over to you, Matt.
Yeah, beautifully put. And actually, probably not since Spaces Deep have I had such an instantly emotional reaction to a Hawkwind track at time of listening. The first time I listened to PXR5, I took it to the gym and I was on a treadmill. And when High Rise came on, I actually had to stop the treadmill and just listen to this track. It grabs you by the heartstrings from the first note and doesn't let you go until way after that song has finished. It's really good as both an idea and how it is delivered. It feels somehow to me like this is Hawkwind's Comfortably Numb, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. And you actually said this to me and I'd already thought of that myself only a couple of weeks earlier when listening to it. It's the dominance musically of like a chord sequence rather than a melody or a tune. largely, I think, the chord sequence that that organ is playing. And you get after the first chorus is finished, that little instrumental piece where the vocals drop out, and you get that really overdriven organ playing that chord sequence. It's really powerful, which is the similarity between the two tracks, I think.
I also think the way that the bass sounds, it's very thick and round and plods along, but the notes it makes are very poignant as well. So I feel like that also works in a kind of Floydian way. And I know that they worked with the producer of Floyd before. I know that that was Curb Crawler, which wasn't really the same. But yeah, when I first heard this track, I thought this sounds like it is going for the emotional.
Yeah, absolutely true. Dave Gilmour himself from Floyd produced Curb Crawler, and we discussed on Astounding Sounds how, you know, how Alan Powell and that were trying to evoke a Floydian sound. It definitely has that to it. And you're right about the bass. Adrian Shaw is phenomenal on this track. It really does carry it along beautifully. And the delivery from Calvert, there are certain lines in this that just give me chills. When he talks about tearing out telephones and rip out the pages of directories and wreck all these. Love that line. And then later on, there's the tentacles of human gore splattered on the pavement from the 99th floor. The way he delivers those lines are just absolute bite in them.
Yeah. And I think the delivery in this is as important as the content of the lyrics. Like we've heard before, some of the ways where things have been delivered previously are vital to the ways you hear them. And this one, it's done in a very subtle way, but there's emotion cracking through that. It does sound like the delivery of someone who is genuinely upset at the situation. Again, it has a slight resignation to it again, where there's not much that can be done. This is what it is. And someone is just recounting the reality. It's not angry, it's disappointed, which, you know, feels even worse. And I feel like that sense of disappointment is always very well carried by a slightly overdriven organ sounding synthesizer, which is almost kind of cheating emotionally sometimes, because it's very easy to just lean on that and then have that really just like, you know, get you. I'm not saying it's cheating, because it's effectively done, but you don't want to do it all the time. You want to do it when it matters. And again, counterpointing that fractured, overdriven, distorted drone with a ponderous, melancholic bass line does that lovely counterpoint of just somehow just like, again, when all the notes change at the same time, every time that happens, it just feels like another little stake in your heart in terms of how this is affecting you.
It's almost shocking, this track, because of all the brilliant things Hawkwind do, delivering a massive slab of emotion and pathos and poignancy, that's not usual for a Hawkwind album. That's not what you expect from Hawkwind, which I think kind of trebles the impact of this when it hits you.
It's strangely poignant from an emotional point of view for me. Because when I've been listening to this track on repeat, doing a lot of dog walking, I'm surrounded by these. You know, I'm in the city of high rises. So it becomes this interesting way of looking at the city for like the 4 minutes this is on, and it very much changes your feeling from this idea of this amazing New York skyline to actually these towering potential suicide machines. And actually even just thinking about things like the Empire State has 12 feet high wrought iron fences around it to stop it becoming a suicide machine. And also it always makes me think of Grenfell, obviously back in the UK, and the fire that happened there.
Yes, absolutely.
If they are built by uncaring people and maintained by uncaring people who just see their buildings as contents and not homes, then they do become, if not suicide machines for Grenfell, murder machines. And that is a terrible thing. We've said before, there's been ideas around this, almost like the idea of like, if you see a person as a robot, you treat them differently. You don't see them as a human. And I think that has been a theme that Hawkwind have used before. And I think is a fairly poignant thing that they use to talk about the loss of humanity when you don't treat people as humans and you do treat them as numbers or collateral or as strangers even. You dehumanize them, and in so doing, you treat them differently. The idea of a high rise, no one who's built a high rise or thought of a high rise has ever lived in one. it's a solution to a problem which was kind of thought about by a psychopath who never thought about the lasting problems that making these things would cause, because no one really wants to be in one of these things. I have friends in New York who live in much more luxurious versions of these things now. So, you know, they don't mind. But the idea of a tower block in like East London or something is not seen as a luxury thing. And it does perpetuate this feeling where if you treat people like animals, they do kind of devolve a bit. And like you said, that idea of someone who is smashing up a phone, I've never even really thought of the idea of why someone would do that. Or I have, but I've had it dismissed to me from people who are much more like, oh, you know, they're thugs, they were going to do that anyway. But actually, I do like the way this is spilled out, where actually it's an act, the only act of rebellion you have against the situation you find yourself in. And it's funny that they actually finished that, be a rebel without a cause, because I think, no, you do have a cause. This is justified. This is a righteous fury that you have. The only thing you can take it out on is the thing that someone who owns the building also owns. And yeah, fine, there's the other way of looking at it, that yes, you're destroying it for everyone else, but also you feel like you put me in this situation and this is how I act. And I'm glad that you said that actually this is said from experience, because I didn't know that. Again, in the same way that we supposed that Freefall was about someone actually skydiving, I supposed that you could look at these and make all this up or read that book and talk about it. But the fact it is actually Calvert's real life experience does add that extra bit of grit and relatability to this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I thought when I saw that this was based on J.G. Ballard, obviously he's a magnificent writer, but I remember even in the 1980s, there were discussions about estates and tower blocks and the crushing effects that these things have on people. So it was clear to me that it was based on more than, you know, just I'm going to write this great song about this book. I wasn't so aware that he'd actually lived it himself, but that just does add to the emotion of the situation. I think with some of Hawkwind's songs, where the lyrics are so much kind of at the forefront of the song, the music is really good background for the lyrics. But in this case, I think the music is adding to the lyrics and adding to that emotional punch that the lyrics give, which is slightly different, I think, from what they've done before.
Yes, and I think that, I don't know this for sure, but I know that you said that some of these were live overdubs and some of them were studios. This sounds like a studio track. And I think this wouldn't have been as good if it had sounded live in the same way that Uncle Sam's on Mars does. The breakout between the overdub and the live changes, I think, because of the intensity and the swirling, like amalgam of sounds that uses to drive its foreboding and its intensity. You can almost hear that sound and almost imagine this pyroclastic cloud of dust from a apocalyptic storm coming towards you, where this is actually much more pared back. It's almost funereal in the way that it talks. You know, the fact it's so slow and so plodding, but again, so deliberate. Even the high-rise chorus sounds like it's some kind of like eulogy for this idea, like they're using its name, but they're doing it again as a kind of lament that we've heard before.
Yep, I agree. I think this actually is live, but it's almost certainly had an awful lot more done to it. The only one, I think, that the only track, which is the five of them together in the studio making a studio track, is Jack of Shadows. I think everything else is either Dave kind of off doing his thing or them overdubbing live tracks. But I agree that this one has had the most work done to it. A beautiful track, an emotional high point, I think, of the Hawkwind catalogue to date. Even Dave's guitar solo, which you don't necessarily need, but I really like Dave's guitar solo in this. It really adds to the music rather than just being, we need a guitar solo here, please.
Yeah, I think what it does is it gives you the increased suspense before we get to the inevitable of the death. We've been talking about a suicide machine. We've been describing these boxes as just like, you know, containment facilities. And then there's the break. Because you know it's coming, it just prolongs it in this horrible agony that it is before, you know, you hit this release and we talk about the suicide from the 99th floor. I know what you said there about the, well, someone said he jumped, but we know he was pushed. I think that's one of my favorite lines of the whole thing, because when you think about it, he was pushed by the environment. And that reminded me a bit of, you know, Gormenghast.
Yep, Titus Groan.
Yeah, that book is a fantastic book because the castle is almost a main character and is described like that. And, you know, like the way that the castle is designed, the rooms that it has, even its decoration impacts people's memories and impacts their emotions and changes their behavior. And I felt like there was almost a Gormenghast feel to the end of this about, like, if it is a suicide machine, then eventually it's going to win. A bit like Death Trap in a way that, like, you know, this might be an inevitability. And I think that even as we said before about the idea of dehumanizing, the fact that the person who lands is described twice as a kind of subterranean animal adds to that idea that all humanity was lost before he'd even jumped. When he hit the ground, he looks like a starfish. Then you have tentacles. All of those things are very non-human. And so I think it's very graphic to get the idea of the starfish. There's an almost beautiful way of describing what it would be like to have your body hit tarmac from that high up. And again, makes you think about it. But again, describing it as a starfish, describing tentacles for me makes you feel like these people aren't human in the eyes of the people who are looking at this mess. So I think that even then, that idea is just carried through from beginning to end with this absolute certainty, which means, like I said, that like this grabs you from the very beginning and doesn't ever really let you go. In fact, I could have stood for them to have thought of another verse for this, you know, in order to just make it a little bit longer. Because I do think that compared to like some of the tracks that we really like, the Hawkwind have, this is like a fraction of the size. And yet it's walnut tight. So, you know, I think it's nice as it is. But if it was a little bit more, then maybe that would have been interesting just to see where else we might have gone with it. I also was thinking about if ever there was a track that someone should cover, like now, either this or Uncle Sam's on Mars would be an amazing thing to have, like an up-to-date version, because these things sound great, but they sound very of the time. And the idea of updating them to show what has changed would be interesting, you know, it would be put maybe like a nice point in its own right.
That's very true. It definitely comes to mind when these words of Robert Calvert seem as relevant now as they ever did. So we come out of that emotional climax into a track which is the polar opposite in tone. I've got one very short quote here, again from Joe Banks and his book, Days of the Underground, because I'm reading this one out because actually it made me laugh, because we know that PXR5 is broadly about the breakup of the band in the Astounding Sounds era. So what Joe says in the book: the album ends with the fun, if slightly daft, PXR5 and another stab at being self-referential. But whereas Days of the Underground did it with a certain ironic elan, Brock delivers his tale of ejecting former bandmates into space with a none too subtle glee. I laughed when I read that because it very much is that, but it's a fun track. And almost, I think, you can only follow High Rise with something like that. It would be impossible to do anything that was supposed to grab you emotionally after that one.
For sure. Again, I wonder if I was making this album, would I put anything after High Rise? Would I just leave it at that in the same way that they did with Quark? I think that may have been a more heavy but effective way of doing it. But also, Hawkwind are a political commentator and not a political band, I feel. So they've made their point, but they don't want you to go away completely empty-handed emotionally at the end of the album. So having this as a little coda is also kind of fine. I get why they did that. Other bands may have landed there and then be like, cool, that's your problem, bye.
I do agree. I actually quite like the fact that PXR5 ends the album, simply because the mood that High Rise puts me in isn't really one that I want to carry around with me for too long. I love it while it lasts. PXR5 is like a sorbet, if that makes any sense. A musical sorbet.
This is a surprising return to the ideas of In Search of Space, of all things. You know, like they've gone right back to being space rock, but not just space rock, space themed. We haven't had a lot of that. The rhythm section's working overtime on this track for sure. You know, big hammering fills, which is, again, feels more classic Hawkwind when they had two percussionists for a while. The people being thrown out of the band, aka the spaceship, is interesting because the lyric is their life support couldn't handle it, so they died, which makes it again sound like they were on borrowed time anyway, because
I think in Hawkwind that's probably true.
Exactly. So I did like that idea that it was life support that got them and not their misadventure or their kind of murder. It was more just like inability to survive. I think the solo for me is the most fun and rewarding thing. For me, it feels like a relay race. as in like you get this lead guitar that then passes the baton onto this squelchy bass that then passes it onto this violin. And for me, the violin is the best part on this. It's just super scratchy and like really close to the microphone. And then they do this nice stereo field where it all goes all over the place and then crashes back into PXR5, which I don't know what that means. I'm assuming, is that the ship now? I thought the ship was called the Hawkwind. Is this a different ship? What the hell is going on? I don't really know.
I've never heard an explanation of it.
I'm sure there isn't one. The only thing that I got out of PXR5 is that the way they say it, PXR5 is exactly the way they do the edge of time. And I was wondering, is that another acknowledgement of previous Hawkwind triumphs? Because I can hear PXR5 and substitute Edge of Time completely in the way that the diction carries it, which I thought was interesting. But, you know, there's still exile and mystery and death in this whole idea. So it's not a super happy story, but the music is certainly more upbeat in its delivery. So it kind of washes away some of that poignance left by the double B-side smackdown of Robot and High Rise. By the end of the whole album, I have taken on board so many ideas that an idea that I can't grab massively hold of, like another spaceship that might be called something else and about trying to find another race or whatever it is, I'm like, I'm not going to come with you on this. I'm going to listen to it and it's going to wash over me, but I'm not going to try and put too much effort into decoding this one. I'm assuming this is just kind of like a, you know, like a fun piece and a chance for some of the musicians to get something out of their system by like thwacking some drums and just like going ham on a violin.
Yeah, as Joe says, the entertainment in this, I think, the amusement value is this song about three of our crew who were with us then did not survive with this very jaunty music. There's a collision here that shouldn't be, but is. That amuses me. Also, writing a song about the fact that three members of the band are no longer in the band. If you do this on the next album, Dave is the only one left. So there is only one survivor from PXR6. So, yeah, it's a fun way to finish off. And that is the music of PXR5. And we will come to some conclusions on PXR5. But first, we need to look at this particularly dangerous album cover. So the album cover for PXR5 is by artist Philip Tonkin, about whom I know very little other than the fact that he also does the next album cover. And it is this plug that on the front cover has some, you know, typography over the top of it and looks kind of fun. But it's became famous because of the back cover that features a British mains plug wired in a dangerous way. And shortly after the album's release, the illustration of the plug was covered by a sticker obscuring the image. I think it's very sensible because it is dangerous. I know having flooded my flat after referring to the big Black Sabbath book of plumbing, and my car failing its MOT after referring to the Pink Floyd guide to car maintenance, you know, you should never be looking at album covers to wire your house.
Yeah, you're right. It's a bit silly, isn't it? Like, is anyone going to refer to an album and then try and do this? Like, in that case, should the Beastie Boys have their albums recalled in case someone tries to fly their planes into mountains? And, you know, like, is anyone worried that someone is going to fall off a cliff on a horse because of Warrior on the Edge of Time? Seems odd.
Of any band, if you're trying to wire a plug and you've got no reference and there's no internet, you don't know what to do, and you're, hang on, I've got an album that does this. If you then went, it's a Hawkwind album, you would immediately cease and desist from this exercise, surely, immediately. But yes, I mean, it's a shame because, funnily enough, my album is a re-release. The back cover doesn't have the warning sticker on the plug, which actually would have been nicer. They've just taken it off entirely. So the back of my copy of PXR5 has the track details running down the right-hand side and nothing. Which is a bit of a shame, really, looking at the images of the back cover as it was meant to be and the one with the warning sticker. I don't mind either of those. I prefer either of those. I might have to nip onto Discogs and see what I can find.
Isn't the front cover also showing three equally badly wired plugs? You just can't see it because it's slightly obscured by the Hawkwind logo.
I would expect so.
The red is still going down, the blue is still going up, and the ground is still going into the fuse. So it's exactly the same thing.
Yes.
I don't know quite why they got annoyed because you can actually see the plug in this one. You know, it perplexes me. I also think if you put a sticker on this saying this sticker must not be removed, what is the first thing that's going to happen? You know, if anything, it's just calling into sharp relief the thing you're trying to obscure from. Even the non-stickered version has something in the bottom corner saying government and health order warning this wiring can seriously damage your health. And I wasn't sure if that was a joke or whether or not that was like their first attempt at trying to placate the record label or health and safety or something, or whether or not that was something that they felt like that was funny. But either way, there's already a warning there. But I do feel like if you're making your first thing and there's a warning, maybe rethink it. But also, I also think it's dumb that anyone had a problem with it.
Yeah, no, totally. I'm with you. As album covers go, I do actually rather like it. I'm not sure what the relevance is. Hawkwind album covers are just visually really interesting as a general rule. They don't tend to do, in fact, they never do, as far as I can remember, the band on the album cover or these kinds of very generic things. They're always interesting pieces of art. And this is the same to me. It's another interesting thing to look at.
It took me a while to get into it, but now I do quite like it. Compared to the very sort of scientific stark shot of 25 years and then the much more detailed design of the interior factory of Quark, to have this, which is very flat and graphic and actually doesn't have that much going on, is interesting. I was wondering whether or not that wiring of a plug had any kind of extra poignance. Was it a prank? That's why they say don't do it. Is it something that changes polarity? You know, I was wondering whether or not there was something where if you saw that and you knew, you're like, oh, they're being cheeky or anarchic or something. Like if this was the ingredients for a Molotov or something, you'd be like, okay, well, that's deliberately provocative. But if it's just like this kind of graphic plug thing, it bemuses me slightly, but there is a graphical charm to this. I don't know if you know this, but does Barney come back for an album ever?
I don't think so. No, I think that's it for Barney.
The fact that you told me that he died horribly young has meant that every time there's been a new album, I've always winced to know which is going to be the last Barney cover.
Have we seen the last of Barney? I can't remember exactly when Barney dies, but I don't think he's involved in any more Hawkwind album covers. He did lots of other album covers and art and videos and things apart from Hawkwind. I think he keeps going in the 1980s, but I'll have to check it. But yes, I think that may well be the end of it with him and Hawkwind.
Well, if this has been his body of work, then I think he had a lot to be proud of. The variety, if anything, and again, the imagination in a lot of it was very cool.
Well, as Joe said in one of his talks when we brought up Barney Bubbles, he said it was actually said of Hawkwind that Hawkwind's music wouldn't have sounded as it did without Barney's images. He's very much a part of this kind of artistic commune, if you like, as Calvert was before he was the lead singer in the band. You know, there were things he was writing into his spoken word. Barney is kind of an extended member of the band, really, I think. I don't think that's too much to say at all, because he was in on the stage shows and, you know, and everything. A lot of it was, you know, his vision. So, yeah, brilliant, as you say. There is also the sentence, which you may not have seen, which is written right underneath all of the album credits, that says, "This is the last but one." And at the time, people thought, okay, the next album's the last one then. But obviously what that refers to is the fact that this was recorded before 25 years on. But I can imagine information-starved public not getting that. It seems quite doomy, doesn't it?
Considering we weren't sure whether or not Hawkwind was going to carry on or Hawklords was going to be a thing or this or that or the other, it does feel like by putting that on the album that they have doubled down on Hawklords being the next progression of Hawkwind and they are kind of letting it go. So it'd be interesting to discover why that is a thing and why that changes.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, clearly Hawkwind continue, but this is the end of this lineup. It's the end of the Hawklords lineup. It's the end of the Charisma label relationship. It's the end of Robert Calvert being the band. It's the end of a lot of things. And it's the end of the 1970s, which is incredibly neat and tidy. It means that the end of our season, as it is as well, putting decades as seasons, we'll have a lot to look back on. But before we do that, we need to draw a few conclusions on PXR5 and draw some tracks from it. So, Matt, you've been through the ringer with PXR5. Where do you land?
I think that on the whole, this feels like Hawkwind is consolidating some of their main ingredients in new ways and seeing what still does and doesn't work for them. I feel like we're on this experiment ride with them during this time. I feel like the return to spacey themes is fun, but it does now clash a little bit with that contemporary social commentary, unless you push metaphors quite far. That idea of like, we're talking about the here and now, but we're also talking about space and we have fantastical themes, and trying to figure out how all of that consolidates into an album can be difficult. I think they found some solace in that almost kind of X-Files-y, Close Encounters kind of idea of kind of what happens when science fiction realizes that, you know, that there aren't aliens and we have landed on the moon and it's not made of cheese. And now what do we do? So, you know, things get a bit more surreal, and that's where we start to get a lot more imaginative James Bond gadgets. And that's where we start to get the idea of like, well, maybe aliens came here and messed with us, and that kind of idea. Or people just go straight into the future, and then, you know, then it's carte blanche. We can do whatever we want. But with things like Psi Power, and I feel like that's them starting to have that idea of like, well, if this is the world we have, then how do we mess with it in slightly more relatable ways? Which is then why the actual track PXR5 for me comes kind of out of nowhere, because I feel like they've been exploring that a bit more of it, then like saying, no, we can still do whatever we want. So I think it's a nice way of rounding out the decade. For me, it's almost a little bit, you know, those kind of TV shows when they turn a clip show basically into another episode. You know, they have some kind of contrivance for everyone to get back together and go, oh, remember this thing? And then they do a cutaway. There's some of that in here. You know, maybe even me hearing PXR5 sounding like The Edge of Time is me trying to like retcon the whole decade that we've talked about, because I know the 70s is coming to a close. Maybe not, but I do feel like things like Death Trap are very much a callback to previous things, and even like robots, automatons, that kind of thing, we've heard of that kind of thing. So again, they're still exploring familiar themes. And even for me, like the Uncle Sam's on Mars big jam really reminded me of something like, you know, Opa Loka, that idea of them just having this big mix of instruments all like playing off each other, and they do that to really good effect, but then layering over a story over the top of it, wouldn't you know, creates an entirely different thing. And so that for me feels like that experimentation where they're kind of taking all their bits, shoving it together and going like, well, how does this work? So it still feels experimental. It still doesn't feel as cohesive as maybe like, you know, the album which is the number one album which they've done, which, you know, like you can't touch in terms of like when everything aligned for them and we're like, we're gonna do this. But in terms of them exploring what is sonically possible for them, I found, again, things to enjoy and things to dwell on in ways that make me feel like it's always nice to see what the next album brings. And while it feels kind of a shame that this auspicious This Is The Last But One thing hangs over the end of the decade, and like you said, a lot of stuff finishes, the spirit of Hawkwind is large enough that it can survive a complete catastrophic meltdown of almost everything that could possibly kill it and still find itself immune in some way. So whatever vestiges of the band make it into the 80s, I can only be interested to see how that works out.
Yeah, I think Hawkwind has already survived three or four such events. And somehow, as we've kind of said before, the personnel in and out means that the ramifications of personnel in and out almost ceases really to have any great meaning, just part of how the band operates. It's going to be an interesting ride for sure. So, Matt, we need to choose some tracks. First off, what is the track for the Hawk Binge Master Playlist?
I think it has to be High Rise.
Round of applause.
This one's difficult because there are some great tracks to select from this. But again, in terms of just ones that I would come back to, ones that I immediately had a reaction to, I mean, it's probably not a big surprise that this would be the track that I pick. I'm sure that this would be many people's favorite tracks. But, you know, I'm not trying to overthink the master playlist. You know, I'm not trying to try and be like too like deep cutty or too weird with this. I think the master playlist generally has my most emotionally attached tracks that we have. And there is absolutely nothing that touches High Rise in terms of something which is going to emotionally connect you from the get-go and still deliver a very poignant message to humanity that even if we had knocked down every High Rise since this was made, you could still think of this as an allegory for what it means to treat humans with respect. So I think this is an absolutely timeless tale that ends tragically that makes you feel like we can all do better. And I think something that does that for us can only be healthy in a world where a lot of music can be so disposable and snackable. It's nice to remember that sometimes you can have a real thing to say.
Beautifully said and beautifully chosen. And what will join High Rise on the Hawk Binge Sessions playlist alongside those tracks we talked about earlier today?
This one was harder. And the one that I've chose, the reason for it, slides into a little bit of some future advertising. So I'm going to pick Uncle Sam's on Mars. I think it's a great track. Again, I think very, very poignant, very salient, very well produced, takes things that I've half liked about Hawkwind and turned it into something new, fresh and interesting that I love. I think the delivery is great. And the reason why I didn't choose Robot, which I also really, really liked, is that because we are planning on doing a Christmas bonus end of the 70s podcast in which we will look at the B-sides and rarities that we have not looked at. You know, we've looked at the albums as they are, as they shipped originally on vinyl, but there are plenty of missed, flipped and skipped tracks on the digital re-releases that we have not talked about. And we have a plan to go through all of the missed, flipped and skipped of the 70s albums and produce an extra playlist of the best of the B-sides. And I did a little bit of sneaky looking, and I know that there is a live version of Robot as a bonus, and there isn't a live Uncle Sam's on Mars. So I'm putting this one into the Sessions playlist, knowing that I'm fairly sure that Robot will make it onto the other playlist. So this is me covering my ass a little bit, but that is how that's going to shake out.
Well played. There are indeed some excellent cuts that I've not allowed you to listen to before. I always send you, this is the last track and you must stop listening after this track. And you've played by the rules. But yes, that's going to be a fun one. We also have, reaching the end of series one and the end of the 1970s, I think it'll be fun to have an episode where we actually chat about your perception of this whole period, your takeaways from the band and the band story and everything that we've covered. And I can think of nobody better to do that with than Mr. Hawkwind in the 1970s himself, Joe Banks. And fortunately, Joe is up for this, so there will be a Christmas special, if you like, where the three of us do discuss Hawkwind in the 1970s and cover some topics that we chatted through at length that are kind of maybe not the ones that make it into, you know, books and videos that we've uncovered that we'd like to explore. And Joe's bang up for that. So we're excited about that one, and look out for that. I have a bit to read on this, given we've kind of reached the end of another era of Hawkwind, from Ian Abrahams in his book Sonic Assassins, because we've had these two massive eras, if you like, everything up to and including Warrior on the Edge of Time, and then the Charisma era that happened afterwards. And you commented on the 25 Years On podcast that actually 25 Years On was quite a difficult album to even find. And certainly on Google Music, which is how I tend to stream things, a couple of these albums only exist as curated playlists rather than the albums themselves. And it's interesting where these tracks kind of, you know, lie in the pantheon of Hawkwind albums. And wrapping this up, Ian says something which I hadn't really thought of before, which was a really, really good point. So Ian says this: let's not see Hawkwind's tenure on Charisma as being the second string in their existence, the slightly poorer relation to the classic era of their time on United Artists, where arguably the big hitters of the catalogue, Space Ritual or Hall of the Mountain Grill, for instance, benefited from the continued exploration of that portion of the back catalogue by United Artists' successors, EMI. With the murkier contract position of A Warrior on the Edge of Time aside, EMI kept the early Hawkwind LPs in print, transitioning to CD when the vinyl became superseded, and reinventing the albums with remasters, expanded editions, and associated spin-off collections. That excellent service, spearheaded more recently by Nigel Reeve, maintained a presence on the shelves and the racks of record stores for those LPs, almost in a consistent, unbroken run, keeping them familiar and available and granting them an accessible status in rock history, as well as part of the band's history. Virgin acquired Charisma and released the four Charisma albums as vanilla budget CD editions in the 80s, then allowed them to drift out of print. The used vinyl market aside, these classic albums therefore became the province of the Hawkwind enthusiast rather than the browsing music buyer. And in that way, they became almost caricatures of themselves, most vividly astounding sounds, amazing music, which picked up a mythological epithet of being the worst Hawkwind album, without many newer converts actually placing the needle on the vinyl and hearing its myriad complexities. In retrospect, though the band made some notable twists and turns during its Charisma contract, the four albums released on the Mad Hatter's label contain within them a trio that are genuine peaks of creativity, imagination, and an almost art house experimentation. And although PXR5 is a disjointed record by its very nature, individually the tracks in isolation are certainly not a disappointing part of the band's canon. And I think that's very true. I'd never considered that before, but these albums do end up being less celebrated maybe than the kind of these early albums because of the way they were treated in the 80s and 90s by the record label that acquired them. So yeah, I wanted to read that out. I think that's quite well said by Ian, and maybe that's something that we'll explore in our 70s special. We like to see where these albums live in Hawkwind fandom, just as a bit of a litmus test. And PXR5 actually comes in at number 10, which is pleasingly high, I suppose, given where it could have been, given the story of how the album was made.
And also given how it did in sales as well.
Yes, exactly. Very much so. It's clearly one which has found its audience after the fact. There was some shock that 25 years on only came in at number 21. And actually, there is a small clerical error there because I forgot in that ranking to remove the live albums and compilations from the list. So actually, 25 years on comes in at net number 16, which is still below the first Hawkwind album. So still quite a surprise to be down there. But PXR5 comes in at number 10, which is fairly respectable. We are actually going to be releasing the Hawkbinge Sessions playlists volume 3, and they are available on Spotify. And you can find them quite easily, Matt.
You can. If you search Hawkbinge into Spotify, you will find all the podcasts, but you will also find the playlists, especially if you click on us. We are called Hawkbinge as a Spotify user. You can also check the description of this podcast or on YouTube. You can check the description and all our links are there. That will be the master playlist, playlists 1, 2, and 3, which also include our own personal listening to mix it up, all in lovely chronological order. So you can follow along as we inserted them. I actually like going back and listening to it, and I will be certainly listening to the master playlist again now to remember exactly what I liked, because to be honest, this has been a long time in the making, and it'll be fun to populate this final playlist as the bonus.
Absolutely. And if you want to get in touch with us about those playlists and tell us if you like them, if you enjoy them, if you're following along, Matt, how can you do that?
So we are on the socials, on Instagram and Twitter. You can get to us at Hawkbinge, nice and easy. If you want to send us something more long form, we accept all kinds of email at podcast@hawkbinge.space. And if you want to listen to us audiovisually on YouTube, you can put Hawkbinge into YouTube. We are pretty much the only thing that comes up. We have almost 60 followers there, I think. So if you follow us on YouTube and we get to 100 followers, we can change the URL to be Hawkbinge, which will make us a lot easier to find. So the audiovisual version of the podcast is there as well.
Outstanding. And that is the end of PXR5. It is the end of season 1 of Hawkbinge. But look out for those Christmas specials that we'll be doing before the end of the year with those B-sides and bonus tracks and with the one and only Mr. Joe Banks. And until then, I have a bomb to defuse using the Deep Purple guide to bomb disposal. And if I survive that, we will both see you next time round. Right, let's do this.
Take it away.
Yes. Oh, that's a good start.